Well, our task this morning is to talk about how the brain processes emotion and how the brain develops both pre- and postnatally, and how that process eventually gives rise to what we see as emotional maturity during adolescence and adulthood. So there'll be two basic questions we'll be asking, and that is, how does the brain integrate emotion and allow it to be expressed as we see it in one another as we converse? And the second question is, how does emotion mature during the postnatal period particularly? Now, to begin this discussion, we really have to go back to the 19th century to a very famous neurologist named Paul Broca. Paul Broca actually was famous for his studies of the aphasias following strokes and other lesions of the central nervous system. However, very late in his career, he became interested in the problem of emotion in human cognition. And he had reported some seminal observations, and they were based upon two particular structures in the brain, the cingulate gyrus and the hippocampal formation, which are found on the mid-sagittal surface of the human brain. And together, these structures are called the limbic lobe. Now, Broca had looked comparatively at several species and noted that if you looked at the brain of a rat, a cat, or a monkey, that this limbic lobe structure showed a remarkable degree of preservation over the course of natural evolution. However, when one looks at the surrounding neocortex, which phylogenetically appeared later, one can see that as we move along the evolutionary spectrum of mammals, that there was a progressive increase in the amount of neocortex surrounding this limbic lobe structure. And these observations led Broca to suggest that the limbic lobe may play a particularly important role in the integration of emotional experience with higher cognitive function, and that in the course of evolution, the neocortex was playing an increasing role in integrating this emotion with cognitive processes. Now, in today's world, we speak more about the limbic system, as you can see here. And you can see in this diagram that the limbic system underlying this limbic lobe structure, which is seen superficially, is far more complex than the previous slide would suggest. You can see there are many different structures that are present. Within this diagram, we can see the cingulate gyrus, as pointed out by Broca. We can also see the hippocampal formation here, which is located in the temporal lobe of the human brain. In addition, however, there is a third structure that is often not spoken about as much as the cingulate gyrus and hippocampus, and this is called the amygdala. And it is a subcortical structure that appeared later in evolution, around the same time that the hippocampus was appearing. And as we have discovered over the course of the last 20 to 30 years, the amygdala is very intimately interconnected with both the hippocampal formation as well as the cingulate gyrus. In fact, in the 1990s, a famous neuroanatomist called Gary Van Hoosen did classic neuroanatomic studies in which he injected an antrograde tracer dye into the amygdala, a specific subdivision called the basolateral nucleus, and followed this dye along the fibers of the amygdala, and demonstrated very compellingly that many of the neurons within the amygdala actually send an abundant projection to the anterior cingulate gyrus. In fact, Gary Van Hoosen demonstrated that this projection is what he would call, quote-unquote, massive in nature. So the projections from the amygdala to the anterior cingulate gyrus are considered to be one of the most important of the amygdala projections. You've already heard that the amygdala also projects to the hippocampal formation. So we have a triad of structures that are interconnected in very intimate and important ways. Now, these are the three structures. So we have the anterior cingulate gyrus, the hippocampus, and the amygdala. And we consider these as part of the cortical limbic system. And they are considered to be key elements in integrating emotion with cognition. Now, the anterior cingulate gyrus has been found to be an important part of the cortex, one in which affective experience or emotion is experienced at the conscious level and integrated with other aspects of higher cognitive function. The cingulate gyrus also plays a key role in selective attentional responses, and I think this in part tells us that the things that we tend to pay attention to are also those things that we feel strongly about. So if there is an intense emotion associated with an attentional response, that attentional response will also be intense in nature. The cingulate gyrus also has extensive interconnections with the hippocampal formation, that other part of the limbic lobe that we were talking about. But it's noteworthy that the hippocampus has been found by neurologists and neuroscientists, neurophysiologists, to play an essential role in memory and learning. Now, we can't go into all of the aspects of how the hippocampus integrates memory traces and allows us to learn, but it's important to note that this relationship is absolutely integral to affective experience. But we can't understand it fully unless we bring the amygdala into play. The amygdala, as a part of the limbic system, has been implicated in playing an important role not only in emotional responses, but also stress responses. And specifically, the reactions of the amygdala allow us to learn things that are associated with emotion and stress. And this occurs in part via connections between the hippocampus and the amygdala, as you had seen earlier, but also involving the connections between the amygdala and the anterior cingulate gyrus. So together we have an integral network, one that is phylogenetically older in nature within the human brain, that helps us in the experience of emotion and allows us through emotional experience to learn material that is triggered in relation to the emotions that we are feeling. So, an important question to ask in this regard is, how does the limbic lobe develop? Is it there at certain times of development that are key in nature? Now, in order to answer this question, it's necessary to go back to the embryonic period. And specifically, we'll begin by looking at a four-week-old embryo, as shown here. The four-week-old human embryo is a relatively simple structure. I like to say that it's somewhat worm-like in nature. The topmost parts, or the telencephalon, are located here. It's the telencephalon that will eventually give rise to the neocortex. And then there are other structures, such as the diencephalon, shown here in red, and midbrain structures, and eventually the spinal cord, that are already present by 4 weeks of age. Now, if we look a little later, 1 month later, to be exact, this embryo has changed dramatically, not only in size, but also in complexity. You can see that the telencephalon has become dramatically larger than it was just 4 weeks before. And you can see that the structures that are contained within the cranium, the diencephalon, which is essentially a bridge between the telencephalon and the mesencephalon, which is part of the brainstem, have all increased in size. You can see that there is a notable turning of the central nervous system on itself, so-called flexures that allow this to take place. Now, as we move in a caudal direction, that is, toward the tail, we pass through the brainstem and eventually into the structures that give rise to the spinal cord as we know it in adults. Now, this diagram is showing us somites of the embryo at an early stage of embryonic development. What are somites? Somites are essentially the primordia of what will go on to become vertebrae and muscles associated with the vertebral column. In addition, these somites are associated with specific segments of the spinal cord that will innervate particular parts of the body. Now, all of us are generally aware of the fact that the spinal cord innervates our arms and our legs and allows us to walk and to write on blackboards and so forth. But a lot of people are not aware of the fact that these structures within the central nervous system also play an integral role in the experience of emotion. Now, let's look at this a little bit more closely. Up here between somite number 1 and somite number 7, there are onlager of neurons that comprise the future parasympathetic nervous system, which uses the neurotransmitter acetylcholine. This part of the so-called autonomic nervous system sends innervations generally out to the viscera of the abdomen in particular, and here is shown the esophagus, the stomach, the intestines, and the colon. And we know that in emotional reactions, the gastrointestinal tract can play a very integral role. You can be upset and feel sick to your stomach if you're very anxious. If you're extremely frightened, you can even develop diarrhea, which is an irritability of the colon. A second part of the emotional reaction involves the other component of the autonomic nervous system, which is the sympathetic component that uses adrenaline as a neuromodulator. The neurons that give rise to this portion of the autonomics are located lower or beneath somite 7, between somite 8 and I believe it's somite 28. In any case, the autonomic innervation that arises from this portion of the central nervous system is extremely important because it gives rise to a regulatory mechanism for the cardiovascular system. So the regulation of heart rate and the regulation of the tone of all the blood vessels of the body are essentially mediated through this portion of the autonomic nervous system. So you can see that this is laid down early in embryonic development. Now, if we contrast this picture with what the autonomic nervous system might look like, this shows the parasympathetics playing a major role in innervating the digestive system and also the bladder, and the sympathetic nervous system, the cardiovascular system. But if we look a little bit later, what we can find is that the peripheral autonomics, composed of the sympathetic nervous system and the parasympathetic nervous system, has become a very complex system in the adult body and brain. Shown on the left side in red are those fibers representing the sympathetic nervous system, and shown on the right side in blue are those fibers representing the parasympathetic nervous system. Now, in the within the limits of this lecture, we can't possibly go into all of the details of this diagram, but what I'd like to do is to walk you through what I consider to be some of the salient points that bear on the question of how we experience emotion. You'll recall that the sympathetics are involved in the mediation of cardiovascular tone, and you can see that there are fibers that are passing out of the spinal cord through the so-called sympathetic chain and appear to be going to all of the organs of the body that the parasympathetics are going to. There's an important difference, however, and that is that these sympathetic fibers are primarily controlling the vascular supply to these organs of the body, with the exception of the heart, where it plays a direct role in increasing heart rate. For the parasympathetics, however, they go to the muscles of these organs and control the contractility of these muscles. So the gastrointestinal tract will move more rapidly if the parasympathetics are firing. The only exception to the rule that we've given to the parasympathetics is that they too also innervate the heart, as do the sympathetics. But in this case, the parasympathetic nervous system slows heart rate. So the sympathetics and the parasympathetics are working basically in a mutually antagonistic way, the one increasing heart rate, the other decreasing heart rate. Now, within the context of a discussion of emotion, this is extremely important because when we become angry, as I stated earlier, or anyone becomes angry, your heart rate will increase, and it's the sympathetic nervous system that's mediating that response. There are some individuals who become so anxious that they actually will pass out. The reason they pass out is that their parasympathetic nervous system is becoming overactive with respect to the heart and causing the heart rate to slow down so much that they can't keep their body in an upright position and they simply collapse. Once they collapse and pass out, the system corrects itself and the heart rate goes back to normal. But now, the point in showing this diagram is to emphasize that when we're experiencing an emotion, we're experiencing it at a gut level. There is a visceral component of emotion, which is extremely important. But it's also important to take into account that we don't simply react arbitrarily to things going on around us. We as humans particularly experience emotion together with cognition. We will have a thought or a perception of a person or an event that is taking place, and that person or event will be really at the root of the emotional response that we have. And once that occurs, then the brain will be sending impulses down to spinal cord levels and invoking the entire body to become involved in the experience of the emotion that is taking place. Now, the prenatal human brain is important to look at and understand in terms of these systems, because our second question was, when does emotion mature? And really, to answer that question eventually in the course of this lecture, we'll have to understand how the central nervous system is set down. Now, this diagram shows us the human central nervous system at various stages of development, beginning with 25 days up to 9 months. Now, you can see this upper tier is where the human embryo looks like a worm, as I referred to it as earlier. But it's important to emphasize that this is not on the same scale as these diagrams below. And the diagram is showing us that actually this 25-day-old embryo is about this size here, the size of a dot on this particular slide. So between 25 days and 9 months, there is essentially an exponential growth in the size of the brain that is taking place. This means that there must be a tremendous amount of activity occurring which is generating neurons and allowing those neurons to go to the appropriate places and hook up in appropriate ways. Now, before we move on to the next slide, I would just like to point out two terminologies. Here we have a gyrus in the human brain, and lying between gyri are invaginations called sulci, or as in the single sulcus. Now, the gyri and the sulci, as you can see from this diagram, are not present to an equivalent degree at various stages of fetal life. And you can see that they're fairly well developed around the time of birth, but if we go into the second and early third trimesters, the gyri are not well formed at all. In fact, they form at different rates, and the rates at which the gyri form are actually rather surprising to discover. Now, for example, if we look at this diagram that shows gyral development between 12 and 27 weeks in utero, we can see that the brain shows very few gyri when we look at the surface. As we get later toward 27 weeks, we can see that there are some gyri. But if we look at an earlier time point, that is 16 to 19 weeks of development, essentially during the second trimester, there are very few gyri, but there is an exception, and then that exception is shown by this arrow, and that happens to be the cingulate gyrus. The cingulate gyrus, remarkably, is one of the first gyri to begin to form and potentially come online functionally. If we go to a slightly later time point, 20 to 25 weeks prenatally, we find that a second structure that becomes very apparent in the cortex is the hippocampus. So the cingulate gyrus and the hippocampus are among the earliest structures to appear. And in a way, this isn't surprising because we spoke about the fact that from a phylogenetic standpoint, these two cortical regions were among the first to form. There is an inherent paradox here in the sense that the hippocampus is the oldest portion of the cortex and appears later than the cingulate gyrus. So there's a little bit of a flip-flop there, but I think it does graphically demonstrate to us that the biogenic law that had stated that ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny cannot be taken in a very literal way. It is approximately true that there's a reflection of evolution and the development of human brain, but the devil is in the details, we might say. Now, if we look at the next diagram, set of diagrams, which show the human brain at 28 to 44 weeks of development, it's very apparent that gyrification, as it's called by Cognoscenti in the field, has progressed to a marked degree, and just prior to the time of birth, the fetus shows many gyri. And we'll just back up for a second here. Now, an important question that we have to ask is, how do these gyri form? What is taking place in the tissue of the cortex that is allowing gyrification to occur? And studies over the last 30 years have shed a great deal of light on the specific details of cortical development, and we'll review those now. So, cell migration into developing cortex is considered to be an important part of what is occurring. And in the most basic sense, what is taking place is an expansion of the cortex from the earlier time points to the later time points. Within the earliest time points, that is in the first trimester of embryogenesis, cells are actively dividing, so mitotic proliferation is taking place to a very marked degree. After a certain point, however, some of the cells that have been formed begin to migrate upward along radial glia. And as development continues, there's a so-called cortical plate that forms where these young, poorly differentiated neurons accumulate. And eventually, these cells will form layers, and the individual neurons will differentiate into specific types of cells that subserve specific types of function within cortical circuitry. Now, Pashko Rakish, together with Richard Sidman here in Boston, performed a seminal series of experiments looking at cell migration in monkey. And what they did was to essentially mark the birth date of neurons using a radioactive nucleotide, thymidine. And once the thymidine was incorporated into the DNA of cells, they could trace those cells and understand which cells in which layers of the cortex had been born at what stage of embryonic life. And the surprise finding was that there was an inside-to-outside migration of neurons. That is, the neurons that are found deeper in the cortex were born the earliest, and the neurons that were found in the most superficial portions of the cortex were actually the latest to be formed and to migrate. So there is an inside-to-outside migration that takes place. This in itself is interesting for a couple of reasons. One is that the newer cells actually have to climb over the older cells that have been formed. They do so with good manners and observing protocol so that there's a minimum of chaos that's taking place. And as Martha Stewart would say, that's a good thing. The other point that can be made is that these superficial layers of the cortex are actually the ones that are also formed later in evolutionary development. So the development of the cortex, again, reflects the evolutionary development of the cortex. So the deeper layers of the cortex will eventually go on to have connectivity with subcortical structures that evolved earlier, and the superficial layers of the cortex will go on to form connections with other cortical areas and are presumed to play a major role in higher cognitive function. Now, let's look at what happens to the cortex as the cells have taken their appropriate places in different layers of the cortex. And we'll start with 7 months prenatally. And we have a representation of a Golgi impregnation that was performed by an investigator named Marine Padilla in 1974. Now, at 7 months in utero for humans, you would say that this looks like a relatively complex set of neurons and processes. And you might even begin to speculate that at 7 months in utero, that the cortex may already be ready to process information in complex ways. Well, if we compare this to what we see at 7 months postnatally, I think you can see that there's a dramatic increase, not only in the size of the cortical mantle, its thickness, but also in the amount of processes that are present for individual neurons. If we look at this particular cell here and compare it to that cell, you can see that this cell has many more dendritic branches that are present. Now, those cells that we were looking at are called pyramidal neurons, as you can see here. And these are dendrites, and specifically they are called apical dendrites. Now, if we look at a higher magnification with a microscope, we can see that these apical dendrites actually have little protuberances, And at even higher power, we can see that these protuberances have a distinct structure to them. These have come to be called spines, dendritic spines, and are very important because as they appear during development, they are associated with a dramatic increase in the functional competence of the neurons showing these spines. Now, this diagram is showing us that neurons in the brain, in addition to dendritic branches, as we were just discussing, and spines, also have pre-terminal elements or axons coming in and forming boutons, as they're called, or swellings. And these swellings contain synaptic vesicles. Now, on the next slide, we're going to look at synapse formation during development. And what you're going to see is that early in development, as dendrites are already present, axons will begin to send endings toward those dendrites, and the earliest stages of synapse formation will begin to take place. Now, at this stage here, the preterminal axon does not exactly look like a mature synapse, nor does the dendrite. If we look over here at a mature synapse, we can see this dendritic shaft has given rise to this spiny protuberance, and the preterminal axon has formed a very clear apposition with the membrane of the spine. The preterminal axon contains synaptic vesicles that contain neurotransmitter, and the spine has formed what is called a membrane specialization, a thickening of the membrane that facilitates the processing of electrical information that is triggered by the release of neurotransmitter. But you can see that the formation of a mature synapse is gradual in nature. And first, the spine starts to appear as just a ill-defined protuberance, then it begins to take on shape and so forth, but eventually we have mature functional synapses. Now, there have been some who have quantitated synapse formation and have shown that postnatally there is a sharp rise in the numbers of synapses that can be counted. Now, I don't want to dwell on specific rat data, but we can summarize what has been learned about the development and maturation of neurons and processes both pre- and postnatally. And this is shown in this table. Now, I'll walk you through this table one step at a time. It's organized according to mitosis, that is the division of precursor cells and the formation of primordial poorly differentiated neurons, the migration of these neurons, the formation of axons, dendrites, and functional synapses. And we're going to look at these aspects of neuronal differentiation at the stage of the first trimester, the second trimester, the third trimester, and the postnatal period. And what you can see, I think, is very clear that mitosis, mitotic divisions, are really largely taking place during the first trimester. There is still some cell division taking place early into the second trimester, but not enough to really seem important in the context of this discussion. During the first trimester, migration is an important aspect of what is occurring, and axons are beginning to form in a meaningful way. Dendrites and certainly functional synapses are not present to a significant degree. During the second trimester, however, as mitosis has ended, migration is occurring exuberantly, and cells are beginning to take their proper places within the cortical mantle. Axons are growing out at a greater degree, and even dendrites are beginning to be visible. Functional synapses are still not present. During the third trimester, however, migration is coming to an end, axons are really beginning to grow, as are dendrites, and we begin to see the formation of functional synapses. But during the postnatal period, it is obvious, of course, that there's no further mitosis, no further migration. Axons are also beginning to stop their growth. Dendrites are still growing, although the rate is slowing down, but it's functional synapses between axons and dendrites that are becoming one of the key elements of the maturation of the cortex during the early postnatal period. So as a child is born, there's still a great deal that is taking place in their cortical development that is of a critical nature. An important question, however, is whether it's really all over at that point. Is it all over by the end of the first year? Is it all over by the end of the second year or the fifth year? 30 years ago, it was often said that the development of human brain was finished by age 5. What was that based on? That was based on the observation that the motor systems were fairly well formed by age 5 to 6. However, there was an incongruence between that concept and the fact that Piaget had suggested that the development of abstract thinking took place at 12 years of age. So one could scratch their head and say, well, is it possible that some aspects of brain development are continuing up into the early teen period? No one had really looked at this in a systematic way. Now, let's look at the cortex here, and this just really summarizes what we were seeing. We're seeing that the cortex is expanding in size, but what we're looking at here is now not prenatal. We're looking at postnatal cortex, and what this is showing us is that as we grow postnatally, the thickness of the cortex continues to expand up until a point. Now, this set of photomicrographs was actually taken from studies of rat, but the same principles apply for human brain. This point here, postnatal day 20 in the life of a rat, represents the beginning of the adolescent period. And in rats, it is showing us that the objective growth of the cortex is pretty much stopping at this point of time. But we can ask the question, even though the volume of the cortex or even the weight of the cortex might not be changing after adolescence, is it possible that there are other things that are changing? Let's look at this a little more closely. Peter Huttenlocher, who I believe is retired now, but was at a medical school in Baltimore, and I always forget the name of that school, Johns Hopkins, that's right. He actually was a pediatric neurologist and obtained tissue from children who had died prematurely and processed the tissue for electron microscopy and looked at synaptic density. Now, this particular graph is taken from the visual cortex, and he counted and determined the numerical density or the number of synapses per unit volume in the visual cortex of children. And what he found was that these synapses reached a peak in the visual cortex somewhere around the 10th postnatal month. But he also observed an interesting and unexpected phenomenon, which was that this density went on to decrease well into the postnatal period. He coined the term pruning and suggested that there was a superabundance of synapses formed, that some of which were unnecessary for functional competence, and that the brain gradually weeded out the ones that were not needed for well-functioning circuitry. Now, this work was extended by Huttenlocher to the prefrontal cortex, and what he showed there was that a similar peak and fall-off occurred in the prefrontal cortex, except that the peak occurred much later in development. In fact, the peak occurred at approximately 5 to 8 years of age, in children. But the fall-off or pruning process, as he called it, continues in a similar fashion. Now, if we look at some data for the weight of human brain, this is wet weight, at different ages during the postnatal period, what we can see is that the weight of the brain increases during the first decade of life, and by 10 to 19 years of age, the weight of the brain is really close to a maximum in humans. From 20 to 29 years of age, there is a slight further increase in the size of human brain, but I can tell you that this is entirely related to males. Males between 20 and 29 years of age will show another approximate 8% increase in the size of their brains. But for the purposes of this discussion, I think we can say that by adolescence, the size of the brain is pretty much leveling off. So this data presents a problem for us when we think about the concept of pruning as presented by Huttenlocher. And here's the problem. If synapses reach a peak and begin to fall off in number, but the brain is not changing in size, what's filling the space that's been left by those synapses that are being resorbed and deleted from the population at large? Something must be filling the space, otherwise the weight of the brain would be expected to go down. So let's consider what some of the possibilities are for the neural elements that might be filling the space left by these pruned synapses. Now, one possibility has to do with myelin formation. Myelin, as you know, is the insulating covering of axons. And during the development of the central nervous system, the appearance of myelin often indicates the appearance of functional competence for a particular system. So it's an important marker that pediatric neurologists pay attention to. Now, Paul Yakovlev was a Russian neuropathologist who worked in the Boston area. And he was intrigued with the possibility that myelination might occur into adulthood. And in fact, he published a schematic diagram, these white lines representing the extent of myelination into different stages of the postnatal period. This is a nonlinear axis, and it actually goes out to the senium. But what you can see is that Yakovlev was suggesting that early on, some of the more primitive parts of the central nervous system at spinal cord and brainstem levels were showing the greatest degrees of myelination, and that's true, one can observe this. But he speculated that if we were able to measure myelin material in the cerebral hemispheres, that we might find that myelination there continued out as late as 30 years of age. Now, he did not have empiric evidence for this, and it's very interesting that he published this diagram in a review in the mid-1960s, and it's probably one of the most quoted papers in developmental neuroscience. But most of the people who cite it have never read it and therefore do not realize that there was no empiric data that was actually used to generate the diagram. But in my laboratory, we were very intrigued with this possibility, mainly from the standpoint of our interest in schizophrenia and the fact that this disorder begins between 15 and 25 years of age. And we were very interested in the possibility that a normal developmental event might serve as a trigger for the onset of the disorder in people who carry susceptibility genes or other risk factors for schizophrenia. So I went to Yakovlev's collection of brains in Washington, D.C., and reviewed it. And he had suggested that this change was present in the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. And I must confess, I did not see the change, even using as close a scrutiny as I could. However, in the same material, I was able to see a change in myelination in the hippocampal formation. This is part of the hippocampal formation that includes the subiculum and presubiculum. And these two photomicrographs are taken from an 11-year-old and a 17-year-old. And along the surface of this region, you can see this black material, which is actually myelin. And in the 17-year-old, you can see that there's lots of black staining along the surface here. But when we look at the comparable area in the 11-year-old, we see only a small amount of myelin staining. Unfortunately, there were only two adolescent brains in the Akaflef collection. But we felt this was very important, so we collected about 163 additional cases here in Boston from Boston Children's Hospital and the Mass General. And with these cases, we were able to actually measure the amount of myelin in the hippocampal formation at that site that I showed you in the previous slide. And what we found was that between the first and the second decade, there was actually a 100% increase in the amount of myelin material in that portion of the hippocampal formation. This number here is actually a p-value. There were 115 cases represented in these two bars. So this is extremely robust data. In my entire career, I've never worked with such robust data, and I don't expect to ever again. But I think what we had seen in his collection is probably true, that during adolescence, there is a meaningful change in the amount of myelin material in the hippocampal formation. Just as an aside, We did notice that there was an additional 50% increase in that same location between the fifth and sixth decades of life. So up to approximately 55 years of age, there is continued myelination in the hippocampal formation. What does this mean functionally? Well, of course, we don't know because this is a cross-sectional study of people during the postmortem period, so we cannot evaluate them. But we do speculate that it may play a role in emotional maturation. What do we mean by that? Well, there is a literature suggesting that by the mid-50s, the average human changes in certain ways. It's said that we become calmer, and that we become less reactive emotionally, even though we still continue to experience emotion. So it may be that changes in myelination in the hippocampal formation are contributing to this generic idea of emotional maturity that is taking place possibly throughout the life cycle, although we once thought it was mainly taking place during the first two decades primarily. I would also like to draw your attention to this slide where we broke the data down according to males and females. And we're very surprised to note that although during the period of 0 to 5 years of age, males and females showed the same degree of myelination, between 6 and 11 years of age, the females showed a statistically significant increase in the rate at which the myelin was appearing in the hippocampal formation. The females retained this lead, shall we say, if we want to think of this as a competition, through the teenage period and into the 20s, although we can see it was slowing down into the 20s. But beyond that, it evened off, and males and females were approximately equal. And it's been asked, why would females show a more rapid rate of myelination than males? We do know from the educational system that it's generally felt that females are better behaved in elementary and high school, but they also show a more rapid learning of verbal skills and learning in some other areas. And it's possible that this is contributing to it. Now, how? Of course, we don't know. It may have something to do with emotional maturity again, and it could be that female students are better able to pay attention if they are a bit more mature than their male counterparts. Now, we come back to our cortical limbic system diagram and the integration of emotion and cognition. And what we can say now is, looking at myelination, that it is taking place during the postnatal period. And the place where we see those fibers increasing actually includes a structure called the cingulum bundle that connects the anterior cingulate cortex with the hippocampus. So there may be a tighter integration occurring between these key structures. But it's also been pointed out to me by David Amaral, an amygdala expert, that that region probably also contains axons coming from the amygdala and projecting to the hippocampal formation. So we have an important set of connections here maturing during the postnatal period, and this begs the question as to whether there may also be changes taking place in the myelination of connections between the amygdala and the anterior cingulate cortex. Unfortunately, for technical reasons, we are unable to study myelination. There is no discrete pathway projecting between these two regions, so we cannot measure them in a reliable fashion. However, in our studies in rats, we've been able to design experiments to look at this question in a systematic way. And what we have done essentially is to inject an anterograde tracer dye, which I had shown you earlier in this lecture, into the amygdala, and we've allowed that dye to travel along axons of neurons in the amygdala up to the anterior cingulate cortex. I think this just crumped. Is there another pointer? Oh, I can just walk over actually and point. Is this okay? And what you can see is that P6, which is an early stage of development in rats, and P16, there are very few amygdala fibers that we could see in the anterior cingulate cortex. Now, P26 represents an early stage beyond the post-weanling event, and we consider it an early stage of adolescence. And you can see that the fibers are beginning to increase in the cingulate cortex, and through P36 and P45, particularly the P45, you can see that the fiber density has become quite prominent. And by adulthood, or P60, the fiber density has increased dramatically. Now, we're never satisfied to look at data of this type and just evaluate it subjectively, so-called eyeballing. That's not acceptable in the scientific community. However, we were able to quantitate this data using computer-assisted microscopy, and you can see that between P6 and approximately P120, that there is a gradual increase in the projections from the amygdala to the anterior cingulate cortex. This line, of course, marks the beginning of adulthood, so there's a definite increase up until adulthood. It appears as if during adulthood the fiber infiltration is leveling off. But in any case, it's safe to say that amygdala cortical fibers appear to be increasing. Now, let's consider whether these fibers, are actually forming functional connections or are just growing in and kind of hanging out in the cingulate cortex. This, of course, seems preposterous, but in the field of basic neuroscience, we're always constrained to demonstrate synaptic connectivity. Otherwise, people are not quite satisfied. So what we did was we took the anterogradely trace fibers to the electron microscopic level, and you can now see one of these axons right here. It is very large and surrounded by lots of neural structures, and among these are postsynaptic dendrites marked here with the red asterisk. And this is actually a synaptic connection. And we devised a method for quantitating those synapses. This is simply at higher magnification. So here's a traced spine. And I'm sorry, this is a traced preterminal axon. And this is a dendritic spine with which it is forming a synaptic connection. Well, how do we know it's a synaptic connection? We know that because there's actually a postsynaptic membrane specialization that is present there and easy for us to see. And when we quantitated this, you can see that there was a perfect linear rise between P6 and approximately P60. The R correlation coefficient was 0.994. I think that's right up there with the myelination data that we had in terms of degree of significance. So, in fact, functional synapses appear to be forming by amygdala fibers with cingulate neurons. And we went on to extend this to look at specific types of neurons. And I'll see if I can use this. I think actually it's better if I point. What we have here is a confocal micrograph in which we have labeled GABA cells, shown in green, and these green things out here are actually GABA cell dendrites and so forth. And the amygdala fibers are shown in red. So we're able to look at them both simultaneously and look at their interactions. Now, what are GABA neurons? GABA neurons are inhibitory neurons that help to modulate the activity of the system. They help to keep it from firing too much, too excessively, so that a particular behavior does not go out of control. And what we looked at were the connections of the amygdala fibers here and here. Those first ones are called axosomatic connections. The second type on dendrites are called axodendritic connections. And again, we looked at many samples and quantitated the samples in many different animals. And you can see that the axosomatic connection showed a linear rise, though it was somewhat shallow when compared to the axodendritic connections, which showed a very sharp rise between P6 and P60. So we have concluded that the ingrowth of amygdala fibers into the cingulate cortex continues throughout the postnatal period up to the start of early adulthood, and that this ingrowth involves the formation of functional synapses, many of these with inhibitory GABAergic interneurons. Now we come back to our diagram, and once again, we've established that we have myelination taking place postnatally, and now we can say that, is there fiber ingrowth? And the answer is yes, there is a fiber ingrowth going from the amygdala to the cingulate. We do not as yet know whether fibers from the cingulate are growing back to the amygdala, and that will also be very interesting to look at. So, to summarize, the human brain contains regions that are phylogenetically old and contribute to emotion. The brain also has phylogenetically newer regions that contribute to cognitive behavior. Phylogenetically old and new parts are all interconnected with one another and allow emotions and thoughts to be integrated with one another. Pre- and postnatal development of human brain parallels evolutionary development, but as you can see, there are distinct inconsistencies, and the biogenic law does not hold. Postnatal development of human brain continues into adolescence and adulthood. The plasticity of the brain throughout the life cycle provides a unique opportunity to continue maturing and learning. And for those who have susceptibility genes for mental illness, maturational changes at critical stages of development may trigger the onset of illness. So we'll stop there with the slides. And you heard at the beginning of this lecture the two questions we were asking. How does the brain generate an emotional response, and how does emotional maturity occur? And you've seen the circuitry that is involved, and it's very important to emphasize the fact that this circuitry involves some of the phylogenetically oldest portions of the cortex. They have become enveloped by neocortex, and in the course of evolutionary development, and probably also in the course of the development of an individual, this neocortex comes into play in increasingly important ways to integrate emotion with our thought processes, but also possibly to help us to modulate our emotional reactions. Part of this modulation of emotional reactions, which takes place through the adolescent period into early adulthood, may involve the interaction of amygdala fibers with GABAergic interneurons, which are inhibitory in nature. So this may be a very fundamental mechanism that has evolved in the course of evolution to help us do all the things that we need to do in the course of a day. With regard to students in a classroom, these changes may help a student to sit quietly in class, to pay attention to what a teacher is saying, and to use emotion in the service of their learning process. So I'll stop there. And